128 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. The Disciplines of Salvation 129. Dari. Having determined that which is most worthy of consideration, it is then necessary to concentrate the attention upon the task of discovering the recondite truths therein contained. When these three faculties are properly combined, they result in a very high degree of rational penetration. Only such individuals as have learned to observe, discriminate, and concentrate are qualified to occupy executive positions in any walk of life. If, for example, these faculties had been possessed to even a reasonable degree by the early translators and editors of the Bible, what a different aspect would be taken on by the scriptures, for instead of words, 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 the spirit of Holy Writ would have been preserved. In what particular does observation differ from seeing? We prefer to think of observation as the perfection of seeing, and the perfection of seeing is not the mere beholding of an object, but rather the instant discernment of its inner constitution. Observation is not the mere seeing of things, but rather the ability to see through things, making transparent, as it were, their outer nature so that the causal agencies precipitating them may be estimated. Observation, therefore, not only envisages the inherent nature of an object but also its relationship to that which precedes it as cause and follows it as consequence. Readers of the works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle are familiar with the fascinating deductions of Sherlock Holmes, which he was forced to explain in all their detail to the ever-bewildered Dr. Watson. Into the mouth of Sherlock Holmes his creator puts an excellent description of the powers of observation, for it is true that a man's shoes, the manner in which he holds his hands, his air, and carriage all reveal to the trained observer the characteristics of the inner nature which must manifest through these physical peculiarities. The range of human vision is able to take in a comparatively immense area of manifestation, and yet comparatively little of that which is seen is recorded in such a way that it can be evoked by the reasoning processes. Only when the consciousness itself is focused upon the organs of sight is their record preserved. We are most likely to behold and preserve the memory of that 130 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy, which is related to some major interest of life. Thus, a plumber will instinctively turn his attention to water pipes, while the artist will scrutinize the lower corner of the canvas for the painter's signature. In great measure, therefore, observation is directionalized by interest, for man sees first that which interests him. Only after ages of mental unfoldment does man learn that in the last analysis all things are of equal interest. Interest is generally unjust in that it focuses the attention upon some fractional part before the panorama of the whole has been taken into consideration. At this point the problem of philosophic indifference should be considered. The philosopher is indifferent not in the sense that he ignores or refuses to concern himself with the diversity of being, but rather that he refuses to become biased by directionalizing his interest primarily upon any single phase of life to the exclusion of the remainder. We study observation first because of its generalizing effect. If particularity precedes generality, the result will be mental intolerance and injustice. If, however, specialization follows generalization, then the mind familiar with all may justly choose one phase of existence and develop it with rationality. But when the individual, having first conceived generality and estimated its profundity, chooses to continue dealing with and thinking in terms of generality, he truly remains a philosopher. In his introduction to an essay on the beautiful Biplotinus, Thomas Taylor writes, "But surely the energies of intellect are more worthy our concern than the operation of sense, and the science of universal, permanent, and fixed, must be superior to the knowledge of particulars, fleeting and frail. Where is a sensible object to be found which abides for a moment the same, which is not either rising to perfection, or verging to decay, which is not mixed and confused with its contrary, whose flowing nature no resistance can stop, or any art confine? Since dying there is no portion of matter which may not be the subject of experiments without end, let us betake ourselves to the regions of mind, where all things are bounded in intellectual measure, where everything is permanent and bo. The disciplines of salvation 131. Tefill, eternal and divine. Let us quit the study of particulars for that which is general and comprehensive, and through this learn to see and recognize whatever exists. Observation may be considered as the process of seeing with the mind rather than with the eye. It involves an analysis of the object beheld and the effort to sense or conceive its intrinsic nature. The end of observation is the ability to cognize the life behind the form, the fact behind the fancy, the truth behind the symbol, and the self behind the not-self. Through observation one is able to discover wisdom in the words of fools and foolishness in the words of most wise men. Observation, furthermore, is the ability to comprehend the pervading wholeness. He who sees may see the parts, but he who observes closely may glimpse the divine cement that binds the fractions together. We live in a world of men who see in part, and are seen in part, who think in part, hope in part, fear in part. The universe is regarded as fragmentary or partitive because we lack the faculty of seeing the wholeness of things. Observation is that transcendent faculty which is able to grasp the wholeness of things in its span of comprehension, whereas ordinary sight is simply the ability to analyze the fragments. Thus sight differs from observation as widely as analysis differs from synthesis. The inherent danger of observation is that when the man of ordinary vision begins to observe the vastness surrounding him, and to realize that even the most minute particle of that vastness is itself immeasurably great, bewilderment ensues. There is an overwhelming sense of inadequacy to cope with the enormousness of the scheme. Then it is that the faculty of discrimination comes to the rescue, emphasizing the fact that if man is not capable of knowing all now, he must compromise by devoting himself to a consideration of only the best. We all realize that in one short span of physical life we cannot do everything, we cannot know everything, we cannot have every thing, we cannot be everything. The major part of accomplishment must be left in the keeping of futurity. So, contemplating the heterogeneous mass of phenomena, the rational soul establishes itself upon the surface of phenomena and directs its attention to the specific task of choosing from all that which is next and most necessary to the unfoldment of the faculty of realization. He who possesses discrimination is master of the science of values. Discrimination is the value sense, it is the ability to look upon a number of objects apparently equally important, and instinctively, unerringly recognize that which is chief among them. Recognizing the whole to be of paramount value, it is then necessary to determine the nature of those parts which contribute most to the whole, or that part of the tangible proximate to the intangible. According to the Greek philosophers, discrimination is that faculty which organizes things into their value sequence, plucking that which is primary first, that which is secondary second, and so on ad infinitum. Discrimination is one of the most valued possessions of the inferior man, for it enables him to conserve energy and thus evade the illusions of time, distance. and quality that he himself has established. Discrimination reveals to man that he has what he saves and loses what he wastes in the realm of the physical. By concentrating the energy upon that which is primary, and hence superior, discrimination results in the proper conservation of life. The length of life is not to be estimated by the number of years that we plow blindly through the mire of matter. Not time but AC. Compellishment is the true measure of existence. The attainment of true wisdom in all its phases, spiritual, aesthetic, and ethical, is the supreme accomplishment. By directionalizing all the energies upon these more important matters, discrimination liberates the mind from the hopeless drudgery of the mediocre. There are three forms of discrimination. The first has for its goal the discovery of that part of visible and sensible things which is primary. It is limited to the form sphere and deals with the problems of multitude and magnitude. For example, in the human body, this form of discrimination determines the heart to be the chief part of the body. The second form of 132 lectures on ancientp philosophy the disciplines of salvation 133. Discrimination is that concerned with the relative integrity or excellence of innate characteristics. It is limited to the comparison of mental and moral excellences. This type of discrimination would elevate the idealist above the realist, the generous above the penurious, the unselfish above the selfish, the beautiful above the so-called practical, for it conceives the greatest good to occupy always the highest place. The third and highest form of discrimination is the power to differentiate between permanence and impermanence, reality and unreality. It is limited to an estimation of the degrees of spiritual poor manence. Through this type of discrimination is established the philosophic fact that the spiritual, or invisible man is the real man. Only the one in whom the faculty of discrimination is highly evolved is brave enough to elevate to the position of first importance and greatest solidarity that which to most men is an intangible mystery. Discrimination is essential to success in every department of life, spiritual, mental, and physical. Men and women in the physical world must choose means and methods of solving the problems of livelihood, and through the use of right discrimination, the material activities can be chosen so as to produce a definite benefit in the superphysical nature. Discrimination differentiates between people and what they do, between the thinker and his thought, between the spirit and its body, between the innate divinity within and the objective material ity without. Discrimination gradually elevates the consciousness of the individual until it is prone to seek out the good as that which is most worthwhile. The height of discrimination is the recognition of the best. Evil is recognized as the least degree of good, matter, the least degree of spirit, the not self, which is the personality, the least degree of the real self, which is the principle. Discrimination has for its arch enemy human selfishness. Because of its innate dishonesty, humanity deprives itself of the right to know good and evil. Justice is symbolized as blind, folded so that its personal attitudes may not influence its decisions. If discrimination is to be of value, it must also be a